What's the Record from KUOW with Steve Scherer. I'm Marcy Silman. And we're going to go now. We move right from football to the Winter Olympics.
Of course.
One of my favorite quadrennial events. They start tomorrow, in case you haven't heard. Winter Olympics are going to be in Sochi, Russia. Even the world's best athletes have to face a very hard truth of competition. Some of them win, but most people lose.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. What does it take to be somebody who wins? Are some people better suited to compete than others? Last year on The Conversation, KUOW's Ross Reynolds asked Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman those very questions. Two of them wrote a book called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. When it comes to being a winner, Poe Bronson says the old adage, practice makes perfect, doesn't always apply.
We're not judged in how we practice, we're judged in how we perform. And you can be one of those people who practices great but performs very divergently. And you need to be able to be good at summoning your competitive energy for that moment of performance. And we wanted to know what makes someone good at that.
Well, John wrote to us on our Facebook page, we get worse when we compete. We get better when we cooperate. So he thinks in our true nature, we would cooperate and not compete. And you do concede in the book, Ashley, that there is a bad form of competition and a good form of competition.
Well, that's right. And what I think we first need to understand is that in productive forms of competition, and I don't think anybody has a problem saying, you know, Michael Phelps is a very competitive guy, right? And that would be something we would want to aspire to. But I think we have this concern, to be competitive, do you have to sacrifice your integrity? Do you have to cheat? Do you have to be willing to sell someone out? And I don't think that's true. In fact, the research says that great competitors, people who are in it for the long term, respect their competition, respect their opponents, and understand, you know, I'm not going to win every time, but I can improve every time. I can use these as new targets to keep going forward. And when we're talking about the difference between competition and cooperation, I think that's a false choice, because so often we're competing and collaborating, right? If you and I are playing an average board game, we're still agreeing what the rules are. We've agreed that we have the same premise. We could play on a team together. So there's a lot of collaboration even in those moments of competition.
You know, I'm glad you brought up teams and teamwork, because everybody doesn't get to play on the team. Just the first string gets to play. So there's competition within the team. How do you nourish that competition but make sure that people come together when the team needs to work together and not be competitive one to the other?
One of my favorite things we learned from this book was time spent with Anson Dorrance, the women's college soccer coach at University of North Carolina, who is probably the most successful college sports coach in any sport in history. And his tactic is he really trains his female players to be competitive in practice. He measures everything on this 23-factor matrix. They're posted on the locker room wall. The players have to work up the ladder to sort of, you know, beat each other in practice. But around games, he de-stresses them. He gives them roses in the locker room. He writes them heartfelt letters about all of the great talents that they have, that they're read aloud in locker rooms. He never yells at them or even raises his voice whatsoever around a game. In fact, his favorite halftime speech he ever gave is they were down at halftime and just walked into the room and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And the girls started taking responsibility and culping to what they had missed and what they could do better, and they went out and played great. So a lot of this is getting people up for competition, but also making sure it doesn't get too stressful on them, that they perform well in the moment.
How do you get someone to be the right level of stress? You don't want to be too relaxed, but you don't want to be freeze because you're too stressed out.
Well, there isn't a right of level of stress for everyone. Each of us has our own level, and where we think this is the level of excitement that I need to do best. You know, researchers found that Bob Hope would tell all of his writers that if he wasn't nervous before going on stage, it was going to be a bad show. So for him, he actually thought a real heightened level of anxiety and stress was going to be beneficial to him. Other people may say, well, I want a little bit of excitement, because if there's nothing, then I'm not even prepared for the fact that I'm going to be performing, I'm going to compete. But it's a wide range. Your elite athlete on a scale looking at anxiety they range from 20 to 67, and the high is 80. So it really depends. But what's interesting is that experts tend to find that anxiety is beneficial performance. They're like Bob Hope. They're thinking, I'm engaged, I'm ready, I'm going to go for it. Amateurs tend to think anxiety is actually a bad sign. They're rattled, they're scared, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to do badly now. But what we understand is beneficial isn't necessarily right. We write about Jeremy Jameson, a researcher who was looking at Harvard undergrads who were studying for the graduate record exam. You know, they're trying to get into grad school. Enormously stressful experience. And right before a practice test, half of the students taking that test were told, recent research says that anxiety may actually improve your performance. If you're stressed, don't think you're doing badly. You might be doing better. And this wasn't then calming them down. Whew, I can be calm because it's okay. They were actually more biologically keyed up.
And how did they do?
50 points higher on the math section than the others. So it was that interpreting anxiety means I'm keyed up, I'm excited, I'm focused, actually helped them.
I'm speaking with Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson. They've written a book about the idea of competition. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And you write that the different levels of competition really bring out different things in people. If you're competing with a lot of people, it can be harder to make yourself competitive.
Anybody in any environment, from kid to adult, their performance will be affected by whether they feel they have a fighting chance, whether if they can dial the effort level up to 10 or 11, that's actually going to matter.
So Tori wrote to us, her idea of competition is, I compete with myself. Is that a competition that hones your skills and makes you get better, Ashley?
Well, you know, you only really know how you're competing against yourself once you've seen what the other guy can do, right? I mean, I can be really proud of the fact that I'm working out in my apartment going, yeah, I've done so many exercises. It's not until I get into the gym and I see what everybody else is doing that I'm like, oh, I'm really not actually working all that hard, am I? So I think at least at reference points, having those competitions with other people help us move further. You know, we write in the book about Jason Lezak at the Beijing Olympics and how he did this phenomenal burst of activity and had swum faster than anybody ever to win the relay. But we all have to remember that almost every other person in the pool swimming with him was also beating the world record time. Hmm. They were so motivated by everyone else doing their absolute best that helped them find their own best.
Alec Baldwin gave one of the great speeches trying to motivate competition among salesmen in Glengarry Glen Ross.
As we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest, as you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
So are threats an effective way to get people to be more competitive in a good fashion?
Some people can handle high stress levels. They're biologically prone to be able to do that. But by and large, when you tip someone from what's called a challenge state into a threat state, physiologically different things triggered. You know, we tell the story of that very scene from Glengarry Glen Ross in the book, and we describe it as an example of prize spreads. First place, Cadillac Eldorado. Third place, you're fired. The inevitable result, as David Mamet constructed, was an office break-in and theft of the Glengarry sales leads, right? And we use that fictional story as a parallel to NASCAR Daytona 500 1979, a day when on the final lap, the Allison brothers and Cale Yarborough had long had a rivalry. And the economists looked back and they looked at the prize for first place and second place and third place. And they said that the spreads were so wide that it would inevitably lead to a lot of crashes, risky driving, too high of speeds, and poor sportsmanship amongst drivers. And on that particular race, as we retold the story, in the final lap, Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough crashed into each other. Richard Petty won the race, and then the cameras panned back to the two crash cars, and the drivers were out of their cars bashing each other with the helmets. Certainly, just like the office break-in, when you overly incentivize and create those threats, you can get very poor sportsmanship, bad competitive energy. It's something that you'll generate whenever you create a winner-takes-all type of scenario.
How much of our competitive spirit are we born with?
Well, I think there are definitely genetic factors, hormonal factors that change how we perform in competition. There's a gene called the COMP gene, which changes how you process dopamine, a neurotransmitter in the prefrontal cortex of your brain. And one version, which the scientists have nicknamed the warrior gene, has your sort of, I call it recycling. It's how much dopamine is sort of transmitted and then reabsorbed into the brain. And the warrior version is 4 times slower than this other version called the warrior gene. And the warriors on an average day have higher working memory. They're able to plan and organize and really get sort of excited and focused about minutiae. And they do really well until experiences of stress. And stress also brings dopamine because your brain is trying to motivate yourself to get through the stressful experience. But for the warriors, it's too much dopamine and their brains just melt down, sort of like flooding a car engine with gas. All of a sudden, just shorts out. Whereas the warriors actually don't have enough dopamine on the average day. They're just not as excited and engaged in the material. So they end up needing stress to do their best.
So does a genetic test tell us whether we're pre-inclined to one or the other?
Well, the genes are really common. 50% of us have both. 25% have just the warrior gene, and 25% of us have just the warrior gene. You know, and I even vacillate, you know, I'm a warrior or a warrior. Well, I worry that I'm a warrior. So that's, you know.
But I'm fighting my warrior.
Exactly. But I think that's the key is then to say, okay, I'm realizing I'm more susceptible to stressful experiences. So can I train myself to prepare for those things so that I'm not so caught off guard? If I'm a warrior, how do I make myself more focused and excited when it may be lacking? So it's not about pigeonholing yourself. It's about using this information to be better no matter where you are.
Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
The book, The Science of Winning and Losing, is called Top Dog.